going to continue with the preface to Pirkei Avos. It may be a while before we get to Pirkei Avos itself, but there are quite a few things I want to speak about in the preface. Today, I want to speak about the name Pirkei Avos and where it is situated in the Talmud. In order to understand, I have to give you a little bit of a preface to the preface. The Talmud, the Mishnayos, are split up into six orders. Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. You should know that, if not from anywhere else, but from Pesach. Shisha Miyodeya. If you're still up by then. Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. Six orders of the Mishnah are Zroim, Moed. Zroim deals with the laws of agriculture, with the exception of the first. The Sdorim are split up into Mesechtas. In one second I'll explain what the word Mesechta means. Tractates. I have no idea what a tractate is, but in any case, I'll tell you what a Mesechta is. So the orders of the Mishnah and the Gemara is an explanation of the Mishnah. So there are six orders of the Mishnah that are split into tractates. So the first tractate, the first Seder, is Zroim, which deals with agricultural laws like Peah and Meiser and Truma. There are Mesechtos, tractates named Peah, Demai, Meiser Rishon, Meiser Sheni, Meisris, Meiser Sheni, and the Trumos, and so on. Shvius, Shemitah laws. And the first one is the exception, which is Brachos. The first tractate in the order of Zroim is Brachos, because before you can eat anything and plant and eat, you have to make a bracha. That's one of the reasons. And the tractate of Brachos begins with the laws of Kriyashma, of Shema. In any case, that is the first order. The second order is Moed, deals with Shabbos, the laws of Erevin, and then Psochim, and the laws of Chol HaMoed, Moed Katan, Chagiga, Megillah, and so on. Tainis, all the laws of the various holidays, and Shabbos. That is the tractates in Seder Moed. Then there's Noshim. Obviously has to do with the laws of marriage and divorce, and there is Yevamos and Ksubos and Kedushin and Gittin and so on. Those are the tractates in Seder Noshim. Then there is Seder Nezikin. That deals with the laws of damages and all monetary laws, Nezikin. And that is Bava Kama and Bava Metzia and Bava Basra, which deal with the laws of damages and the laws of finding lost articles and the laws of acquisitions and chazokos and yerushos, inheritances and so on. And in Nezikin also are all the laws of Sanhedrin and the laws of the Sanhedrin, makos, punishments that are given for the various things by the Sanhedrin and so on. All of that is grouped together in Nezikin. Then there's Kodshim, which deals with sacrifices, and also Chulin, which deals with Shechita by regular animals, and then Zvachim and Menachos and all the tractates that deal with the various sacrifices. And the final order is Taharos, which deals with Tuma and Tahara, all the different kinds of purity and impurity or whatever. Those are the six orders of the Mishnah. If you had to pick where to put the tractate of Avos, where would you put it? In Zroim, Noshim, Moed, Kodshim, Taras, Nezikin. Which one would you put it? Where would you situate it? At the beginning.
I won't say, because
I'm... Okay. You put it in the beginning? Yeah. The Chorot should be with Brachos, right, and has to do with Well, Avos, we said last time, it deals with two major topics. The importance of Torah learning and Midos Tovos. And all Derech Eretz. Torah and Derech Eretz, which we spoke why those two go together. Why, in order to have Torah, you have to have Midos Tovos. In order to have good, real good Midos, you have to have Torah. So they go together. Okay. So you would put it in the beginning. Okay. If you wouldn't put it in the beginning, where else would you put it? Again, Zroyim. Nezikin. That's where it is. Why would you put it in Nezikin?
Because you have to know how to deal with people, not to take their property.
Okay. Okay. So it would seem that Derech Eretz, if you don't want to be a mazik, there's a lot of ways of being mazik people. And one way is by having good character traits. Because if you have a rotten character, you're a mazik. You're going to harm people. So it's in Nezikin. That's a simple reason why it is in Seder Nezikin. But there's another reason, I think. The real name of this Masechta, let me backtrack. A Seder, an order of the Mishnah, six orders, is called a Seder. Why is each tractate called a Masechta? So there are many reasons. I'm going to tell you two of them. One is that it has a connection to the word Masach. Masach is a curtain. In the Mishkan, there was Masach, Pesach, a curtain they put by the doorway. And it's the Masechta is an entrance into a curtain that enters you into a certain subject. So that's called Masechta, a Masach, an entranceway into a subject. Another reason it's called Masechta, the word Moseich, the Msoch, means to mix a drink. To, what's it called, take a, let's say, wine, mix in water, and dilute it. So it's a mixture of various things. Every Masechta is a mixture of many things. It doesn't really stick to the subject only, but it brings in parenthetically and by association other subjects. So it's a Masechta, meaning it's mixed with many, many different things, even though they all revolve around one common subject. So every Seder is split up into Masechtas. Most of the Sdorim and Masechtas, on every Mishnah, there's a Gemara, which explains in greater detail the Mishnah by the Amoraim. The Mishnayos were compiled by Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, who was a Tana, and it contains the words of Tanoim, and the Gemara contains the explanation of the Amoraim, who came after the Tanoim, of the words of the Tanoim. Most Masechtas have Gemaras on them. There are some that don't. Except for Brachos, the entire Seder Zroyim does not have a Gemara in the Babylonian Talmud. It does have a Gemara in the Yerushalmi Talmud, Talmud Yerushalmi. After that, Noshim, Moed, Noshim, Nezikin, and a good portion of Kodshim has Gemaras. Taharos has no Gemara, neither in Talmud Bavli or in Talmud Yerushalmi. It's just Mishnayos. The Yerushalmi doesn't have on Kodshim. Bavli has on Kodshim. There was a famous the turn of the 1900s. Someone claimed to have found a Talmud Yerushalmi on Kodshim, and he published it. And there were Gedolim who gave him an approbation to it. And there were other Gedolim that smelled a rat and said, this is not authentic. The person obviously was a very talented person. And it, in fact, it was a falsification. There was no such thing. What he did was take all the references that earlier commentaries made to the Yerushalmi and compiled them together, added a lot of his own, that with those things answered a lot of questions that existed. There was a Yerushalmi on Kodshim at some point. It was lost. And in the end, he admitted that it was a fraud. In any case, so Avos is one of the Masechtos that does not have a Gemara. It's just Mishnayos. And, in fact, the each of the what's it called, Mesechtos, is split into prakim, chapters. There are five prakim in Mesechta Avos. We have six. We'll get to that at a later time, what the sixth is. But there's really only five chapters in Mesechta Avos. Now, Mesechta Avos, that's not really the name of the Mesechta. According to the Tashbatz, in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, he says that the real name of this Mesechta is Mishnas Chasidim, the Mishnah of Chasidim, of Chasidus. Now don't confuse Chasidim with modern day Chasidim. That is something that is after the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon, where the followers of the Baal Shem Tov took for themselves the name Chasidim, and Memela, those who opposed them under the Vilna Gaon were called Misnagdim, opposers. The truth is that the Vilna Gaon was called Hechosid, Hagon Hechosid. So even though the Chasidim took that name for themselves, that was their choice, but the truth is that they could have easily called the Chasidim Misnagdim and the Prushim, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, Chasidim. But Lamaisa, in common usage, the Chasidic world that follows the Baal Shem Tov and his students are called Chasidim, and those who opposed that originally were called Misnagdim or Prushim, whatever. But that has nothing to do with this Chasidim. Chasidus, a Chasid is somebody who does more than he's required to do. It's somebody who goes lifnim meshuras hadin, beyond the call of duty. That's chasidus. And that is, to a certain degree, a dangerous thing, because sometimes doing more than you have to do is baltosif, is adding to the Torah, which is prohibited. Okay? For instance, somebody comes on Sukkot and he says, look, God said we should take an esrog and a lulav and hadassim and aravos. Obviously, God really likes plants, so I think I'll bring a banana and a watermelon, right? In addition, that's called baltosif. That's adding on to the Torah. God's Torah is perfect, doesn't need you to add. So what is the idea of going beyond the letter of the law? That means that you enhance what the Rabban Shalom wants you to do. For instance, the minimal amount of tzedakah that you have to give is a certain minimum. But I want to enhance and give more. That's perfectly okay. That's not adding to the Torah. That's enhancing the Torah. Going more than you really have to do. So Pirkei Avos deals with things that are not necessarily obligatory, but things that are beyond the letter of the law. Both in Derech Eretz. A lot of Derech Eretz is you have to do, and some is the nice thing to do. It's more than you really are obligated to do. And the same thing with Torah learning. There's a certain minimum that everybody has to learn, and then you can enhance it and learn more, learn deeper, learn more time, whatever, learn on a higher level, right? It's okay to learn shalolishma, to learn for ulterior motives, right? But it's better to learn for the altruistic, for the sake of heaven. And the Pirkei Avos speaks about levels many times that are chasidus, that are beyond the letter of the law. We'll speak about that a little bit more, but right now I just want to get down to the basics over here. So the real title of this Mesechta is Mishnas Chasidim. However, it is referred to as Avos. And that will bring us back to why it's where it is. The Gemara says, "Man de boy le mehevi chasida." If you want to be a chassid, and you want to go beyond the letter of the law, but you want to do it in the proper way, not to go beyond the letter of the law and add to the Torah, but to enhance the Torah. In other words, to understand what God really wants of you, not just what He commanded you. That's called chasidus. Then you should occupy yourself with three subjects. Delve into three subjects which will aid you in being a chassid. One is milei de brachos, the laws of brachos. Mile de Avos, the laws that have come from Avos, and Mile de Nezikin, and the laws of damages. Okay, if you want to be able to go beyond the letter of the law, learn the laws of Brachos and occupy yourself with that, because Brachos make you aware of God in everything. You see Him everywhere. Every time you turn around, there's another bracha to make, which makes you aware of God. So you aren't limited only to the commands, but you get a much bigger picture of the Ribbono Shel Olam's involvement in the world. And then Avos tells you how to act in a way that's more than just what you have to do, but what is really godly, both in Torah learning and in Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, in Midos Tovos. Those are the laws of Avos. And finally, the laws of Nezikin, to make sure that you don't harm people, that you stay far away from being a negative person. So basically, Brachos is more seeing God between you and God, and seeing Him in everything. Avos and Nezikin are basically the positive side of getting along with people and staying away from the negative side. The Asei Tov is Avos, and the Sur Meira is Nezikin. So therefore, Avos and Nezikin go together, because one is the positive side and one's the negative side, right? And it's called Mishnas Chasidim, because by fulfilling what it says in Avos, you will be on the way to be a chassid if you incorporate the other two things. And since Nezikin is one of the other things, and it's very closely connected to Avos, that's another reason why Avos was put into Seder Nezikin, at least in my estimation. Okay, now, the Masechta is definitely not called Pirkei Avos. That is for sure not its name. Okay, it could be Avos, it could be Mishnas Chasidim. But it definitely is not Pirkei Avos. Why do we call it Pirkei Avos? Because we read or learn a perek, a chapter of Avos between Pesach and Shavuos, and we'll see that's one custom, and then between Shavuos and Rosh Hashanah, another custom, what's it called, to continue on, and therefore it's been called Pirkei Avos, because it refers to the learning of it at the proper time in the year when we learn a perek a week. So we are learning Pirkei Avos. We're learning the chapters of Maseches Avos at a certain time in the year. But its name is not Pirkei Avos. Its name is Avos, and these are the chapters of Avos that you learn and read at a certain time in the year, each week, a different perek, a different chapter. So now the question is, so why is it called Avos?
Why Dafka on Shabbos?
Because most of the week people are busy in the Israel Center and other places or whatever. Why Dafka during between Pesach and Shavuos? So first we have to answer that, which is probably a week or two away. Okay. Now, so even if it's called Mishnas Chasidim, but it is referred to as Avos, the subject matter in this Masechta called Mishnas Chasidim, according to the Tashbats, or according to the others, it's actually called Maseches Avos, right, is referred to as Mile de Avos. This is the subject matter of Avos. Why is it called Avos? Avos is fathers. So what does that mean? So there are many, I have about 17 different explanations of why it's called Avos, and I'm going to tell you all of them, and we will elaborate on some. And one reason is that it is called Avos is because what it's contained in this Masechta, which is the basic laws, not laws, the basic ideas of how important it is to learn Torah, and the basic ideas of how important it is to have good character traits and good personality traits and good behavior, are the Avos. They are the foundations. Doesn't mean fathers. They are the foundations. And Av, just like on Shabbos, you have an Av Malacha, which means the foundation, right? These are the foundations of all the Torah. Midos, Reb Chaim Vital says, Midos, good character, is not mitzvos. There's no mitzvah of be humble and don't get angry or whatever. But they are the foundation of all the mitzvahs. They're the basis of all mitzvahs. If you don't have good character, you're not going to be able to have mitzvahs. Mitzvahs were given to human beings, not to animals. And if you act like an animal, there's no place for mitzvahs. So if you have to first act like a human being, first you have to be a mensch. You have to have good character. Then you can have Torah. And first you have to learn Torah. And be involved in learning Torah. And if you're not, you're not going to be able to do any mitzvahs. So the importance of learning Torah and the way to do it, right? Not necessarily the laws, but the ideas, the concepts behind Torah learning and the concepts behind good behavior and personality traits and are the foundations of the whole Torah. So this is utmost. This is the foundation of everything else. That's one reason it's called Avos. Second reason is that this Masechta starts with an accounting of the Mesorah, of how the Torah was received and how it was handed down generation after generation. The Mesorah, right? And these are the Avos of every generation. There was the Av, the father of that generation, who was responsible for the tradition and to hand down the tradition to the next generation, the Mesorah. And therefore, the Abarbanel says that that's why the Masechta is called Avos, because it is the it recounts in the beginning the Mesorah that went from one generation to the other through the Avos of each generation. Another thing is that the truth of the Mesorah is based partially on the fact that parents do not lie to their children. They don't give over as a inheritance to their children lies. A parent doesn't knowingly give his child something he knows is a lie. If he gives it over, he's convinced that it's the truth. So therefore, the fact that we have a Mesorah, an unbroken chain of tradition from the time of the giving of the Torah, also revolves around the fact that that tradition was handed down from generation to generation, and one generation is not going to perpetrate a fraud on another generation. I'll ask, how about Christianity and Islam and all these other religions? There also, the parents are not knowingly giving their children something they think is false. They think it's true. The difference between our tradition and their tradition, which we have mentioned many times, is that if you trace it back to its source, our tradition has a very firm basis and their tradition does not have a firm basis. Meaning the following. If you trace Christianity back to its source, so what is the source of Christianity? The foundation. Why do they believe what they believe? Where did it start? Because one man came and claimed to be the Son of God. Okay? Now, nobody witnessed the fact that he was the Son of God. Nobody saw God gave out cigars when he was born, right? Or any other proof that he was the Son of God, right? Multitude of people heard God say, you know, hey, that's my son, right? He claimed to be the Son of God. Right? And if I was his mother and the circumstances of his birth were that he was not the son of his father but the son of another man, I would also want to say that he was the Son of God and not say what the truth was. So in any case, so his mother had a vested interest why to say he was the Son of God, and he grew up thinking he was the Son of God, and he claimed to be the Son of God. Very nice. You can believe him, not believe him. Right? There's no basis to it. It's just his word. Okay, take it or leave it. What other foundations of Christianity are there? That that he was resurrected, right? He died and came back. How many people witnessed his coming back? So the New Testament says that there was a small group of his closest disciples who had a vested interest in saying he came back, otherwise they were out of a job. Because if he didn't come back, that was it. So they had a vested interest to say he came back. And a group, a few swooning women, women who were fainting at the time that they saw him come back. Now, not to impugn the credibility of women, but swooning women, right? I mean, anybody swooning could see anything at the time, okay? So Christianity is based on hearsay. Someone claimed to be the Son of God. There's nothing to corroborate except his word. And he claimed to have come back, or they claimed that he came back from the dead, which was witnessed only by a small group of his students and a bunch of swooning women. Islam is even worse. What is the entire foundation of the religion of Islam? Muhammad had a dream in a cave one night that the angel Gabriel came to him and revealed to him this religion and told him to write the Quran, revealed the Quran to him, and that was the religion. Nobody witnessed this dream together with Muhammad. He didn't video it, right? He just claimed that he had this dream and that an angel, right? Maybe he had a nightmare. Maybe he had a stomachache that night and that was where the Quran came from. Could be, right? He had a very, however, very cogent philosophical argument that convinced people to accept his assertion. It went something like this. Believe in my religion or I'll cut off your head. Many people found that to be extremely convincing. So his religion spread like wildfire. So did Christianity, because the Rabbanu Shlom wanted it to spread. The Rambam says, God, for whatever reason, that right now is not the time to discuss it, but God wanted Christianity and Islam to spread. Wanted it for whatever reason. And therefore, they were very successful. But if you trace them back to their source, they are based on the word of one man or the word of a very small group of people who were very subjective and had a vested interest in saying what they said. If our religion started the same way and was based on the same thing, for instance, Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam came to the Jewish people who were settled in Tel Aviv and told them that, you got to hear what happened to us. We were, backpacking through Egypt, and they captured us and put us to work and made us slaves. And we were working very, very hard, and then one day, God made 10 plagues to get us out of there. And they went through the 10 plagues that happened in Egypt. And then God took us out of Egypt, and he split the Red Sea for us, and he gave us this Torah, and here it is, believe in it. Then our religion will be the same as theirs. It's basically the word of a few people who claim that they saw something, heard something, did something that no one can corroborate. And you can believe them, not believe them, take it or leave it. And many times people can convince people of things. But again, if you trace it to its source, it would have been based on the word of a few people. But it's not what happened. The foundation of our religion claims that all of these things happened publicly to an entire nation. An entire nation saw these things. You all, Moshe Rabbeinu said, I didn't see these things. You saw them. Atem re'isem, you saw. You saw what the Egyptians suffered with the 10 plagues. You saw Yitzias Mitzrayim. You went through the Red Sea. Not me, all of us. You all saw it. You heard God speak at Har Sinai. And we've explained in the past that there's only a few possibilities of how we could have that tradition. So I have a tradition that my ancestors saw all these things. Not that they heard from somebody that these things happened. Which, take his word or leave it, he could be lying. But they saw it. Now how do I get that tradition? So there's one possibility is it really happened. And these people really saw it. And then it's not the matter that somebody said it. They witnessed it. An entire nation witnessed it. There's other possibilities, though. And that is that Moshe Rabbeinu convinced them that they saw what they didn't see. Not that Yashka came and convinced people that he was the Son of God. But Moshe came and didn't convince the people that he saw these things. He convinced the people they saw it. Very unlikely. I can convince you that I saw something I didn't see. I may be able to convince many of you. But if I would have come here this morning and said, you should know what happened to me on the way to this shir, right? You're not going to believe me. I know you're going to think I'm crazy, but I'm telling you it's the truth. And I come in white as a ghost, shaking, and I tell you that on the way here, I was on a part of the road, there was no other cars, and all of a sudden a flying saucer landed in front of my car, and 10 little green men got out of the flying saucer, started dancing around my car, right? Said L'chaim, got back in their flying saucer and flew off. I promise you it happened. Now some of you may believe me. Right? Okay, right. I'm very charismatic and I'm what's it called? Right, and I don't usually come here and say crazy things like that every week, and if I would 1 week come and tell you that, there would be people who would say, maybe, could be. I mean, why would he lie? What was in the game? So some of you may believe it, some of you never come to the shir again, right? Or many of you may get friends to come to the shir because who knows what's going to be the next week. In any case, but there's a possibility that some of you would believe me. But if I came here today and said the following, do you remember 2 weeks ago, the last time I was here, that while we were in the middle of the shir, a flying saucer came through that door, landed on this table, 10 green men got out and danced around all of you. Do you remember that?
No.
Now, I would imagine that most of you, and hopefully all of you, right, would not believe me. Because I'm not saying I saw it, I'm saying you saw it. And you know you didn't see it. Now, there may be one or two of you, right, no offense, that may say, well, maybe I did, I just didn't remember, or whatever. Okay. But the majority of you, the vast majority, I guarantee, right, no matter how serious and sincere I sounded, would think that I'm out of my mind. Because you know that you didn't see it. So for me to convince an entire nation that they saw things they didn't see, very improbable. Next possibility. Nobody convinced them they saw what they didn't see. They made it up. It was a hoax. The people got together and they said, you know what? We need a nice history. Nothing ever happens to us, you know, that's exciting. So let's make up a history. Oh, we were in Egypt and we were slaves and God took us out and we, what's it called, and we had 10 plagues against the Egyptians and we got this Torah and God spoke to us. Sounds good. They made it up. And they passed this on to their children and their children believed them and that's how we got this. It's all made up by the generation of the people who were supposedly saw it but never saw anything. They made it up. Very unlikely. Why? Because if they just made up a nice history, you know, glorious things that happened to the Jewish people, okay, there are other nations that make up histories too, right? The Palestinians have made up an entire nation, right? With an entire history that never existed of the victories they had during the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War. Look in their history books, right? The Germans, the Russians, right, had history they made up too. Totally made up. And the Germans, after World War I, in their history books, taught that they won World War I. So, that's possible. So, but that would be only possible if it would just be a nice history with no implications. But there's a Torah that was tacked on to this thing. Torah means that you have to fast on Yom Kippur, keep Taras HaMishpacha, keep Shabbos with all of the malachas or whatever, eat kosher. These are things, not marry your sister or your aunt or whatever, which was the status quo in Egypt. Incest was accepted and was accepted thing. The Jews practiced it before the Torah was given, and that's why it says when the Torah was given, they had to separate themselves from a lot of their relatives who they were married to. Amram, Moshe Rabbeinu's father, was married to his aunt, Yocheved. And that's a prohibited relationship after the Torah was given. They did it before the Torah was given. So it wasn't prohibited then. So the Torah changed a lot of the normal social mores of the time. And if people had any doubt, but and therefore, the parents would have had to make something up and know that they were foisting this on their children and it meant nothing, it wasn't true. What parent would do such a thing? Why would a parent put these things on their children knowing that they have no source to it? That's not really true. If I didn't think that God commanded me to put little black boxes on my head and my arm every morning, right, at 6 o'clock in the morning, okay, there is no way in the world that if I thought for a minute that somebody 2,000 or 3,000 years ago dreamt this up, a human being, that I would do it. Why in the world would I want to do such a thing? Put little black boxes on my head, what's it called? I mean, to the outside world, I remember like when I first went to yeshiva in Tells from Miami to Cleveland, I was afraid to fly. So I took a Greyhound bus for 3 days. The people who took Greyhound buses were not fellow yeshiva people. They were blacks, but not this kind of black. And that was me alone with an entire busload of very nice relatives of President Obama. And I remember I used to daven in the morning. I had two shachrises that I had to say before I got to Cleveland. The bus stopped at a diner. They all got out to eat breakfast, and I stayed on the bus to daven. But one of the days, I davened a little bit too long. And they all came back on the bus, and there I was with my my tefillin, right? And I remember one of the ladies saying, "Hey, a party hat." There's no way in the world that I would put on a little black party hat, right, at 6 o'clock in the morning if I didn't think that God said to do it. Right? You have to be out of your mind. I can't understand a conservative reform who doesn't believe the Torah is divine. Why do they do these things? Right? Just because somebody said 3,000 years ago to do it, it's absurd. So, here are parents who know that these little black boxes don't mean anything. We made them up. And we make our children do it? What kind of parent is that? And even if you have some parents that are abusive, but an entire nation of abusive parents, and even if they would do it, but before they died, people usually like to admit of lies or whatever. That's why a deathbed confession is accepted in a court, because that's a time when people tell the truth. Okay, some people only tell the truth then, but Lemaisa, most of the people would have said before they died, call their kids over and said, the black boxes, forget about them. We made it up. All these things, we made it up. Forget it. And then didn't happen. So it's very improbable that they made it up and foisted it on their children, considering the fact that it's not just a glorious history, but a lot of laws too. Okay, another possibility. It never happened, and somebody made it up 1,000 years later. Ezra made it up. He nothing to do one rainy day, made up the whole Torah, wanted to give the Jewish people a little, you know, glorious past. They were in Gaulis, and they were really, really depressed, so he made up a whole beautiful history. And he claimed that 1,000 years earlier, people witnessed this. But they never witnessed it, it could never happen. He made it up. Also, very improbable. Because you're going to now get a whole people believe something that they never heard of. Because if it never happened, then they couldn't have heard of it. The only thing they could heard of was when Ezra made it up and told them that it happened in the past. Didn't you think some little yid would raise his hand and say, Ezra, if these things really happened to our ancestors 1,000 years ago, how come we never heard about it? How come you're the only person who knows about it? And again, if it would just be a glorious history, maybe, okay, what's so terrible to believe in a glorious history? But Ezra tacked on a whole Torah with a lot of laws. Why in the world would they want to accept something like that and believe? If I would tell you, right, I made a discovery that in America, after President Truman, didn't come Eisenhower, but there was another president named Sam Cohen, Jewish president, right? I know about him. Would you believe me? No, because you never heard of him. How come I'm the only one in the world who knows about him? If he really was such a president, somebody else should know about him. Nobody ever heard of him. I discovered him. So somebody's going to raise his hand and say, Ezra, if all these things really happened, don't you think somebody else would know about it? Don't you think that there would be some kind of tradition? We never heard of it, because it never happened. So you must have made it up. And we're not going to keep all these laws because you say. So there would have been a good portion of the people that wouldn't have done it. Like the Jews, you know, we're talking about not convincing Stam people that they saw something they didn't see, or there was a tradition that never existed. We're talking about Jews. It's hard enough to convince Jews that they saw things they did see, let alone things they didn't see. Right? We are extremely stubborn, believe me. Right? As a rabbi, I have a lot of contact with Jews. And they are very hard people. Right? It's much easier to be a priest or a minister, believe me. I mean, I never was one, but Jews, very difficult people. In fact, Reb Shlomo Shofar Hirsch says, the biggest proof the Torah is true is that we accepted it. Because if it wasn't true, we are so stubborn, we don't accept what's true, let alone what's not true. So, there's only one other possibility. And that is, it happened, but not the way the Torah said. It happened in a very small, subtle way. You know, the Jews were working overtime in Egypt, and they made a sit-down strike, and they got out, and there was a puddle they had to jump over. And in 1,000 years of giving it over and telling the story over, it got a little exaggerated. Like the guy who caught a sardine and in the end turned into a whale. After he told the story over, and his children told it over, and their children, and what's the big deal of catching a sardine? So it must have been a bigger fish. It must have been a flounder. And the next generation, it was already a big salmon. Next, it was a kingfish. Next one, it was a whale. And that's how it got changed. And things happen like that. There's a game called the telephone. In England, they call it Chinese whispers. Anybody here from England? Is that true? Okay, in any case, that sounds like an English name for a game that... But in America, they call it a normal name, telephone. What's the game? You tell something to the first person in line. You have 10 people in line. And you tell them to whisper it, to tell it to the next person. And the next person. When you get to the 10th person, you ask them, what did you hear? And it's usually never the same as what you whispered to the first person. It gets changed in the giving over. So that's what happened. Right? The first generation saw jumping over a puddle. Next generation said, well, it wasn't really a puddle, it was a ditch. The next generation was a little river, then it was already, what's it called, they went scuba diving underneath. Next generation, the sea split, and that's how we got Kriyas Yamsuf. Could be. And it makes sense that things change. The only difference is that it's not logical to say that. Because that would be logical if there was one line of tradition. Then it could have changed. But we're talking about hundreds of lines of tradition. Fathers to children and teachers to students all over the world. Imagine if you have 100 people playing telephone. 10 lines of 10 people deep. Right? You have A, B, C, D till I and A1, A2, A3 deep. And here are the givens. You whisper the same message to all the people in the front of the line. We don't know what that message is, but we know it was the same message. Whatever it was, they all heard the same thing. Then you tell them to pass it down. They tell it one over. You go to the number 10 on each line, and you ask them what they heard. And it's the same thing, all 10. Now, there's two possibilities. It's the same thing that started, and it didn't change, and therefore it's all the same, because it started all the same. Or no, it changed 10 times independently, the same way. So they all heard the same thing, the 10 people, but it's not what the first people heard. It's something different, but it changed 10 times independently the same way. Which is more probable? The first way, that it didn't change. Because to change 10 times independently, the same exact way, there should have been 10 different messages by the 10th people. So if there's 100 different lines of tradition, and there's no different opinions, there's no different versions, somebody doesn't say it was scuba diving, and somebody says the Red Sea split. Right? Basically, everybody says there was a splitting of the Red Sea. And it's not only us that believe that. Even the Goyim believe that. The Christians all believe in the splitting of the Red Sea. The Muslims believe that the Red Sea split. There's no other version. Right? I once had a woman come to me to convert. So the first question I ask a possible convert is, what religion are you and why are you not satisfied with your religion? So she said, I'm Catholic and I can't swallow some of the things that Catholicism forces upon us. So I thought she's talking about the fact that man could be a god or virgin birth or some of these other things. So I said to her, could you give me an example of one thing that you find it hard that Catholicism forces upon you to believe that you just can't accept? She said, yes, the splitting of the Red Sea. I said, I hate to tell you this, but we were the ones who went through the Red Sea. She says, you guys believe that too? I said, yeah, and not only that, but the Muslims also believe it, so don't try Islam. Right? If you don't like Catholicism, this is not the reason to become Jewish. So most of the world believe, and there's no other version. If it had changed, there should have been 20 versions of Yetzias Mitzrayim. So the fact that our religion has a firm foundation, it claims that this was witnessed by an entire nation, and there's only four or five possibilities, and all of them are not probable except for one, that really happened. So therefore, this is avos. It's based on the fact that we have a unbroken chain of tradition, which is what Meseches Avos starts with. Moshe Kibel Torah Misinai U'Mesorah LiYoshua. There's an unbroken chain, and that parents do not foist lies on their children. Not knowingly. They can tell their children what they believe to be true. Then we come to the other thing. Christians believe to be true, but the foundation is very shaky. But what we believe to be true has a very firm foundation. Put the two together, and you have a very firm foundation for our belief. That's another reason why it's called Avos. So we finished 2 of the 17 reasons, and Amir Hashem, next week we will cover a few more.